Hi guys, we're back with another Nick Elliott podcast. It's Friday afternoon. I've come over to Peterborough actually in a studio that I use over here quite a bit when we record some of these shows. And I've got a bit of a special guest today. It's going to actually contain some facts. We'll have a giggle, we'll have a laugh, but there'll be a lot of facts. I'm joined by my brother, Gary Elliott, who I've spent 12 months trying to get a date to do one of these bloody shows.
Breaking company.
So we're now here and we're doing it. And great, Guz.
Yeah,
welcome.
Good to be here, man. Yeah, good to be here. Sorry about the 12 months, but...
Don't worry about it. It's a par for course, isn't it, with you, trying to get anything done. Anyway, my brother is a car expert. We've always been, me and my brother have been very lucky. We've always kind of pursued the careers that we wanted to, right from being small, you know. My brother has always been a car man, as I call him. He's been in the industry for how long, Guz?
40 years, I guess.
40?
Yeah.
And so he knows what he's talking about, big time. And we're going to come on to other things like F1 and that later on in another show. But anyway, welcome, Guz.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And we're going to get him to talk about electric cars. The reason for this is because obviously there's a lot of controversy that surrounds these things. Certainly, if your name's Jeremy Clarkson, you know, or any of the Top Gear geezers. You know, they don't support it. And over the recent kind of months, there's been a lot of conversation and a lot of press surrounding, you know, installation of charging points and all this kind of stuff. I don't profess to know jack shit about these things. I do have quite strong views. I just thought it would be an interesting show for Gary to tell us a bit about what these things are really about. I mean, first question is, Guz, do you think they have a future?
Yeah, they do, Nick, without a doubt. They're here. And whether we like it or not, you know, we're transitioning to a world of where we're going to stop manufacturing internal combustion engines, or ICE engines, as they're called, and EVs or derivatives of electric vehicles, you know, are undoubtedly part of the future. Yeah, that's going to happen. Whether it's a single track road or not, I think, is debatable. But certainly EVs are a big part of the future.
What do you think they're going to do about things like, you know, public service vehicles and HGVs having driven on the UK's roads? We've all had a shit full and a gut full of them people. You know, how are they going to move your bag of crisps from Walkers to, you know, Tesco's shelves?
Yeah, well, they're already doing it.
Are they really?
Yeah. Truck manufacturers are already, you know, building electric versions of trucks.
Are they really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
It's the same basic sort of design in terms of a battery and motors, just that it's all bigger.
Right.
And therefore, you know, you need a lot more, you know, moving capability to be able to shift a truck along the road than you do a car.
Right.
So they're already doing it. So, yeah, it's here. Where they're focusing at the moment is very much about things like last mile delivery for inner cities and those sorts of things.
Yeah.
So, you know, those are already starting to come onto the streets of some of the principal, you know, capitals around the world.
Right, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I know there was a story certainly on the BBC a couple of weeks ago about they're going to install, I think it's 40 charging points into some of the main streets in Norwich.
Yeah.
You got the usual kind of people that have, I mean, an hour and a bit about this. And something that I think was a little kind of thin. One of the disabled charities was saying that, you know, some if you got poor people who are in wheelchairs and that kind of stuff, there, they're going to kind of manoeuvre around these constructions, you know, which, are, like I say, I think is a little thin kind of complaint. But I don't know. My view is that, is this really going to work in a country where not a lot does bloody work, you know?
Well, like internet and phone signals and stuff like that. Yeah, yeah. I guess, you know, to give it a bit of context, and whether people agree or disagree with the whole climate change, you know, challenge that we got, and it, in my view, it does exist. And is this a single solution to that problem? No, it isn't. Absolutely not. But when you look at the number of vehicles that are on the road, and don't misunderstand me, I love and will always have a passion for petrol engines, diesel engines, or whatever it might be, internal combustion engines, put it that way. And therefore, you know, they're always going to be a part of the future. But if you look at the number of vehicles that are on the road and the emissions that come out of them, the amount of emissions is just staggering, absolutely staggering. And therefore, you know, we've got to do something that is going to reduce the use of fossil fuels and reduce those emissions over time. It isn't necessarily a single solution, but it's a key part of it. And therefore, I think they're here, they're part of the future, and therefore there is a transition that we need to go on. And that doesn't mean that people won't be able to drive petrol cars and diesel cars in the future. Certainly petrol cars, that won't be an issue. And there are other solutions to those sorts of problems, you know, such as different fuels. And you know, that's already the development that's ongoing. I think your bit about, you know, what works in this country. So the key to adoption of electric vehicles is to have the infrastructure in place. And for years, we've been used to just rocking up to a fuel station every 300 miles or whatever it is that your tank will take you, in the knowledge that there'll be one within the next 5, 10, 15 miles from wherever you are in the country. You know, it's the old Coca-Cola bit, really, of we want everybody to be able to reach out an arm's length and grab a bottle of Coke. And that's almost the model that we have in terms of fuel stations and the infrastructure that we have in the UK. So the clear principle around the frequency of charging, you know, is a big part of what adopting electric vehicles is all about.
Yeah.
And there are good ways of doing that, and there are some challenges around doing that.
Well, I mean, one of the kind of issues is, you know, there's no secret that I live in North Norfolk, which is a very rural kind of place.
Yeah.
I've got several friends that live literally out the way in places in Scotland, you know, which, I mean, how are they going to get around those kind of issues? You know, outside whacking a hole in your wall and plugging it into the 3-pin, you know.
Which is the best solution, I have to say, because it allows you to be able to do it when you want to, which is usually through the night on low, you know, low tariff costs, when you get the benefit of cheaper energy and those sorts of things. The distribution of charging points in the UK now is reflective of the major conurbations. So there are roughly 30,000 charging points around the UK. There are about 50,000 actual plug-in plugs, as it were, within those 30,000 points.
Right.
And 34% of those are in London. So,
you know,
the further away from London you get, the lower density you're going to have of charging points. And, you know, part of that, arguably, is that, well, that's where all the people are and that's where all the cars are. Absolutely, no doubt about that. But is it partly because, well, there's less availability of commercial benefit if I build a charging point up in the northwest of England or up in Scotland, because I'm not going to have many people using it? And you know, that comes back to the infrastructure question of, if you're going to transition to a completely different mode of transport, and that's what it is, then you have to look at the country holistically. And my question is, who's taking responsibility for that? Or is it actually about it being a commercially driven agenda? And I think there's, you know, that's worthy of debate, really. But in terms of, you know, where we're going, of transitioning to an EV future, absolutely. But I don't think it's a single strategy. There's other things. You've only got to look at the numbers. There are 30, depending whose numbers you look at, you know, there are 35 million cars in the UK. Now, they're not going to drop off and stop being used overnight. So whilst progressively we'll see EVs coming through, the time it's going to take to churn that number of vehicles is going to be years, decades.
What's the date he set, old Sunak?
Well, you've got 2030 and 2035, effectively, which is the transit. Although clearly one of those moved, and has been, you know, one of them has been pushed out. But they're the sort of timelines when, and that's about when you will not be able to buy an ICE vehicle.
Okay.
In the future. So it's right at the
That's what they call them, is it? ICE vehicles.
Internal combustion engine. But I've got to tell you, if you haven't driven an EV, and not, I'm not saying, you know, it's a one-for-one swap for a petrol car, but to drive them, they are immense fun to drive.
Are they really?
And they're completely different to drive. Well, because they've got lots and lots of torque. You put the throttle down from a standing start and they immediately are moving, because, you know, rather than having big long transmissions and gearboxes and all that sort of stuff, you haven't got any of that. You've got power source, rubber, and it's like, you know, it's like two hands next to each other. That's how close they are. So the power application to the road is instant. That's the first thing. Secondly is that, and they keep accelerating, you know, they just keep going. And the second thing is that, you know, you're driving completely differently. You barely use your brakes because they've got retardation of when you take your foot off the throttle, the electric motors, you know, effectively become a load against the movement of the vehicle. So they slow down.
Right. OK. So they don't have a gearbox?
No gearbox.
Really? It's just like a piss in milk float?
Well, yes.
In a Benny Hill vibe.
In essence, you know, that's
really
what they are. Yeah, really clever ones, but that's...
Yeah.
That's what they
Two yoghurts and a gold top.
Probably, you know.
On your way home?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so, you know, it's a very, very different driving experience. And therefore, you do behave differently in them, in the way that you drive them, say, particularly for braking and that sort of stuff. You know.
Okay, well, I've got to confess, I mean, I haven't gone near one. There's been no need for me to drive one. But, I mean, let me just take this opportunity to kind of tell you about, or I'll get Gary to tell you about it, what exactly you do, because you work with these things all the time now, don't you? You know, what is your role? I mean, you have your own company, don't you?
Yeah, I do. So I work in the automotive sector, working with businesses that operate in that sector, so OEMs and manufacturers, in other words, and other associated businesses. I also work in motorsport as well, with a company called Manara Motorsport Developments, which is really about providing services and support and expertise into race teams, managing drivers, and working with manufacturers in that sort of space. So yeah, all linked to the world of automotive, whether that's the sort of cars you drive around during the day or the sort of stuff you see on the track at the weekends.
Right, because you spend a lot of time in France, don't you, or abroad?
Yeah, I do.
Working on these contracts and various different, you know, accounts?
Yeah, I do, which is a role that really supports one particular company with, you know, their network of providers across the European market. So
are they directly involved with, you know, electric vehicles or in that particular campaign?
Absolutely. Yeah, providing sort of downstream on-road services and support for them. So yeah, and you know, they're starting to see EVs come through in bigger numbers now, which I think is key.
What about places like European market? You know, how is it being accepted, electric vehicles over there? We'll talk France, as you spend a lot of time there.
Yeah. I think it, you know, it varies across the European region, really. Norway is the biggest.
Norway?
Yeah.
Really?
By a country mile. They're faster in terms of their adoption. They're some way ahead in terms of charging infrastructure and that sort of stuff. There's a combination of, you know, arguably taxation and incentives to, you know, to move people into that space.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And sort of, you know, then if you move into perhaps the southern part of Europe, you know, there's less speed at which they're adopting. So it does vary, and it'll vary across borders, really. Often it is about incentives and taxation, you know, both, that's a carrot and a stick in a sense. But also it's about, you know, consumers and their preferences, as it's always. We're probably, you know, in the middle, I guess, if you want to put it that way.
Well, I was going to ask the question, you know, is the take-up more popular in places like France, which is obviously considered to be bigger than England, you know, and a lot more rural in a lot of places, you know, so obviously they're going to have big-time issues, aren't they, really?
I think, you know, it's a big country and beautiful with it. And so, yeah, I mean, that brings the sort of the infrastructure piece in place, which is why home charging is important, and that's a, you know, that's a part of the solution, as it were. But you know, they're probably similar to us in many ways,
okay,
you know, as indeed we are on many other things. But yeah, there are differences across the region.
Enlighten me, Gaz, in hybrids. I think I've got a bit of an idea what they're about, but what exactly are they about?
They're a combination of petrol engine under the bonnet and a rechargeable, effectively EV battery that can either be charged by the petrol engine or it can be like a plug-in hybrid, PHEVs they call them, which is where you can plug it in as well. And then when you want to, you run on battery, and when you want to, you run on petrol.
Well, let me tell you about a friend of mine that's just bought a Ford Cougar, actually, and that's a hybrid. And apparently, correct me if I'm wrong, you can just plug that into your 3-pin in the kitchen.
Yeah, well, most EVs you can.
Can you really?
Yeah, not all of them. The problem is that the charging time is, you know, is massively longer than it is if you're plugging into a proper installation that you've had done, you know, overnight, which is what most people do. You know, they'll pull up at home, they'll plug it in, and they'll charge it up to 80%, which is usually what's recommended if you're just running, you know, local mileage and that sort of stuff, local trips. And you do that on your app, and it will shut off when it's got to 80%, and you get out and you pull your plug out in the morning and you drive off. Happy days. But if you were to do that and plug it into your 3-pin, you know, along with the toaster and the coffee maker, you're probably into 16, 20 hours or something like that to fully charge it, because, you know, the amp hour is clearly much lower when you're plugging into a 13-pin plug.
And from a commercial aspect, are you charged at the same kind of rate as you would be if you stuck your conventional heater into the wall?
I guess herein lies the one of the black areas, really, or grey areas, I think, as far as people are concerned. Because, you know, going back to what we're all used to, what we all grew up on, is this will do 350 mile on a tank full because I'll get 40 miles per gallon. You know, that's the normal language that we have with petrol cars and diesel cars. But what does 1 kilowatt hour mean to most people from a charging point of view? I don't know. Is that 20 miles? Is that 80 miles? Is that 100 miles?
Right, okay.
So, you know, it's a
what's it equate to?
It's a very different language. But the reality of that, you know, it depends what car you're running, but, you know, what costs you, I don't know, 25, 30 quid in a petrol car probably costs you 7 or 8 quid on an EV.
Right, okay.
So, you know, there's big differences. Not if you're using commercial charging, because the rates are higher. But if you're, you know, if you're charging at home, then your cost to run the vehicle is lower. I guess my wish really is that don't let's forget about what we can do with all the petrol cars and the diesel cars. Petrol cars in particular, because it's quite different, you know, from diesel technology. But there's, you know, what can be done with all of those vehicles to make them better. There's, say, 35 million cars in the UK, there or thereabouts. If you look at the top 10, 12 countries in Europe, you're probably looking at 350, 380 million cars, and they're going to be there for a long while. So whatever you do to be able to improve the the efficiency of those through better fuel, different fuel, is absolutely going to help alongside transitioning to a different way that we drive. So F1, you know, an area that I do some work in and passionate about. In 2026, when the next big rule changes happen, they will move to effectively a clean fuel. Yeah, that's part of the future.
Clean fuel being what?
There are no carbon emissions from it.
So what, they're still going to run the cars on, you know, race fuel? Are they
still race fuel? Still hybrids?
They're just
going to
clean the engines up, are they?
Yeah, they're going to clean the fuel up. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So and you know, that's one of the things that, you know, whether people like Formula One or not, clearly I do and I have always done, but it brings in the best, the very, very best engineering brains in the world. And most of them are just down the road.
Yeah.
Because you've got Silverstone, you've got the F1 teams at Milton Keynes, at Silverstone Circuit, in Oxfordshire, Banbury for Mercedes and so on and so forth. And, you know, who pitched in when we were right in the depths of COVID, when it needed really smart, fast solutions to improve the availability of ventilators? You know, who came to the rescue? Rescue's wrong, because there were lots of people who rescued in during COVID. But in terms of that particular technical challenge, that was the best brains in F1 who created those fast build, and they manufactured them as well, those, you know, fast build ventilators and those sorts of things that saved lives. You know, and
I didn't know that.
There's the, you know, the connectivity between them. But, you know, getting back to the bit. So 2026, we'll see. So it's the next big rule change, really, for F1. And that will move over to not only carbon-free fuel, effectively, it also less fuel. So they're going to reduce the amount of fuel that they can use.
Are they really?
Yeah.
So what, are they cutting the races down? Or?
No. I mean, here's the challenge again, is how do you go further with less? Then let's chuck that problem at F1, because they'll solve it.
Right.
You know, and they will. And so, because in not all racing, but certainly in F1, they measure fuel by weight. It's not volume,
yeah,
because volume varies so much depending upon temperature, altitude and all that sort of stuff. So currently they run on 100 kilograms of fuel. That's their fuel allocation for a race. And assuming what is sort of slated as being the new regulations for 2026, they'll be running on 70 kilograms of fuel rather than 100. So, you know, they've just lost a third of their fuel.
Okay.
But that's not about reducing the races, you know, they've got to find that elsewhere. Different engineering solutions, you know, they call them MGUs, they're sort of under the bonnet elements of turbo heat regeneration and all that sort of stuff. They currently run two, but they're going to run one. They only run one heat generation unit,
right,
in 2026 in the new regs. So again, another engineering challenge, you know, more use of battery rather than perhaps now, although used in a different way, less available, and those sorts of things. So yeah, I've gone off on a tangent now. So
yeah. But not to worry. I mean, it's all relevant to obviously the show and the conversation. I've learnt an awful lot there, which I didn't know. Like I said, I wasn't aware they hadn't got a gearbox or any of that.
Nope.
Very odd. It is, isn't it? Milk float.
Yeah.
It is, definitely.
Yeah, pretty smart looking one, but...
Yeah, bloody hell. I didn't mind a milk float, actually. we had milk floats, didn't we, in Stangraham when we were growing up.
Yeah. The gold tops and all that
in
sort
fact,
of stuff.
We had an uncle that worked on one, didn't we?
We did.
We had an uncle who was a milkman.
We did, for a while. Yeah,
bloody
absolutely.
Hell.
Yeah.
Oral's Dairy, hey, stunned me.
Those
happy
are the
days.
Yeah, I can remember the size of the batteries. They were enormous.
They are wonderful stuff. Well, I tell you, man, I think, yeah, hopefully, you know, the people who listen to this have enjoyed the show. And they haven't been baffled by the kind of science of it. But it certainly helped, I think, and hopefully it's helped you guys to enlighten you into what this this so-called revolution is about. And if you actually do drive an electric car, sell the bugger and get a proper bike. That's my view. But anyway, we wait to see. Anyway, guys, thanks ever so much for coming on. And, you know, all the information and the tech spec and all the rest of it, it's been very, very enlightening and educational, man.
Oh, educational. Good. My pleasure. Great to be here.
We'll be back. We'll be back with another show. Okay, thanks for listening, guys. And for now, guys, happy Christmas. See you later, man.
Absolutely. You too, Nick.